WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all know the calendar breaks our year down into seasons, and if you look at the calendar now, you'll discover that one season is giving way to another. That's right, baseball is winding down, even as football is kicking off, and soon basketball will be added to the mix. It seems that just as the calendar that is governed by the transit of the sun is getting a bit confused with climate change, the sports calendar has long been jumbled. Seasons overlap. They'll be playing baseball well into football season. Basketball lasts well into baseball season. But for most people, this is it. Tis the season for football. We're already two games into the regular season, but race week is just around the corner, too. And since basketball is impending, we're going to look at them all. And to do it, we've invited some, I think, pretty high-profile experts. Mick Mixon is the radio voice, the play-by-play voice of the Carolina Panthers. We used to own Columbia together.
We own that town.
That's right. We still own it. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mike.
Ron Green, Jr. is the sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer. He is in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome to our program again. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And his colleague, Tom Sorensen, also with the Observer, joins us by phone. Was it something we said, Tom?
Pretty much.
Okay. And Jim Noble is a pit reporter for the Performance Racing Network. Good to see you as well. Thanks.
For being here. Pleasure to be here.
I know that pro wrestling, Tom, is one of your favorite sports, and it used to be big here. I just want to know what happened.
Ric Flair got old.
That's it? What about Ricky Steamboat?
All those guys. These guys are all older than I am. And there comes a point where you can no longer hit somebody with a folding metal chair and be credible doing it. Once you hit the age of about 63, you forfeit that.
I wasn't really going to talk about wrestling this morning. I was going to put a joke question at the beginning, but I really am curious about this. Because surely there were people, young people, coming up through the ranks just as there are in any sport. Did something shift in society? Did we change our interest for some reason? Was the arrival of other pro sports, for instance, in Charlotte, indicative that the end was near for wrestling or wrestling?
Wrestling. What happened is that the Crockett family, which owned the ballpark, which owned the minor league baseball team, also operated wrestling out of here. And then they sold out to Ted Turner, and Ted Turner moved the operation to Atlanta. And all the wrestlers had to go, except those with enormous pull, and one of whom was Flair. He stayed. I think it's still probably pretty big nationally, but, you know, tastes change. And I think when World Wrestling Federation became World Wrestling Entertainment, when they had to go to court and prove that they were not a real sport, I think it was sort of jarring to all those people who believed it was a real sport. And that began the great demise.
Did you want to chime in?
I was just going to say, it speaks to my age here, but I remember growing up here and what is now, I guess, Bojangles Arena. They would have the big wrestling matches there. My grandfather would treat me, I guess, and take me there. And they would put 11,000 people in that Coliseum. And that was back before smoking ordinances. This is what I remember.
That's more than the Bobcats get, isn't it?
Well, it was, it would be, yes, much more. I remember you couldn't see to the other side of the arena, but, I mean, it would stop traffic on Independence Boulevard. It was such a big deal back then. That might have even been before Tom was here.
Wow. When I was a boy, I grew up in Chapel Hill, and the notion of Charlotte being a good sports town was almost a joke in among older people. Because what you basically had was Charlotte O's baseball, and you had wrestling, and you had racing. But for a young person, I mean, the stars of the universe were Haystack Calhoun and Brute Bernard and Skull Murphy and Rip Hawk and Swede Hansen, Aldo Bogni, Bronco Lubitsch. I mean, who among us hasn't put the sleeper hold on their younger sister and waited for a long time for her to even get drowsy, which never ever seemed to happen. But I think I agree with Tom. I think wrestling messed it up. They got too glitzy and too much pyrotechnics, and it just became something that was kind of hard to watch instead of fun to watch.
I'm glad I'm finding this out about you now, because when we worked together, I don't know, 20 years ago in Columbia, I didn't know then that you were the smartest man in the room. Let's talk about the Panthers here. We're 1-1 on the season, lost to Tampa. It was kind of a replay of the conventions, but we lost to Tampa. And then given the troubles that New Orleans has experienced in recent months and in the last year, what does it say about the Panthers and its prospects for the rest of the season that we won on Sunday?
It changes everything. It just makes September look a lot better. It makes food taste better. It makes your wife's perfume smell better. It makes your car seem like it's running better. It brings this what could have been a disastrous, because as you know, in the media, we do not take our ball games one at a time. We take them months at a time. And so with the Giants Thursday night, then with at Atlanta on Sunday week, I mean, if you don't beat New Orleans, now you're thinking 0-4 maybe, 1-3 in September, and that would be a very difficult place to recover from. So it's not just what you got by winning, it's what you didn't give up by losing. Does that make any sense?
Makes total sense. Yeah, well, the panic button is never far away, especially early in the season. And I think what you said is right. Everything feels different this week because of what happened Sunday and the anticipation of a Thursday night game. And
when you read between the – go ahead.
I was just going to say, having covered that team back in 1995, Ron and I know, and for about the first 8 years, how many 1-3 and 0-4 holes did the Panthers have to dig out of? And it just changes your outlook. You know, that 1-1 doesn't sound like a lot, but mm-hmm. – in terms of public perception, I thought that was huge last weekend.
But when I was listening to Mick, if you read between the lines, is he saying that we're not going to win Thursday night against the Giants?
Of course not. No, I'm not saying that at all. I think at this point you'd rather be the Panthers than you would be the Giants. I mean, the Giants have to turn the travel nut, and they just played a very physical game against Tampa Bay, of course, as the Panthers did against the Saints. But, no, I think that – When I was looking at the game about middle second quarter, Mike, I thought, you know what, if you take the Saints uniforms away, if you can take their Super Bowl away and the Drew Brees and the six Pro Bowl, if you did not know that these were the Saints, you would think Cam Newton's the best player on the field for either team. And you would think that the Saints didn't have that many guys that would start for the Carolina Panthers. I mean, the Panthers may not have – I was thinking we may not win this game, but we're not the worst team here.
What happens in situations like that? What happened in New Orleans? I mean, why – given everything you've taken away from them, you give it back to them, why didn't that propel them through? Because the Panthers had a lackluster preseason and not a very good season last year either. So why would they be even remotely intimidated by the Panthers?
Well, I'm not suggesting that they were. I'm suggesting that it wasn't a fluke that the Panthers won. I'm suggesting that the Panthers didn't win on a crazy play, a trick play. The Panthers got them blocked up in the run game. It kind of imposed their will, as coaches say, on New Orleans, and then were able to get stops. I mean, the Saints are hard to beat. I mean, they make offensive football look ridiculously easy, so they still gain almost 500 yards in the game. But the Panthers got off the field on some key third downs. The Panthers had two interceptions. The defense not only made the big play early that turned the momentum around, but they made the big play late. The defense was on the field last, and this was a defense that, as we said last time we were here, struck confidence in the hearts of opposing offenses all year last year. So it was key.
So when you win, when you're the Panthers and you win against New Orleans, a team like New Orleans, in your second game of the season, what does that do for your confidence going forward?
Division game, first of all, that's huge, especially when you lose the division game. All your playoff tiebreakers and things like that fall down to that. And like Mick mentioned, that first stretch, this is one of the hardest first stretches that I think many teams in the league will play, and I think it gives you momentum not only going into the Giants game, but then, Mick, you've got 10 days to prepare for Atlanta, which is probably your biggest traditional rival, and with 10 days to prepare, that's an advantage going into game number 4 as well.
It's like hosting go ahead, T.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it also attests to the fact that what you do works. I mean, the Panthers didn't know. I was in Tampa with them the first week, and they were as tight and as nervous as I can remember a Panther team being. And what the victory against New Orleans does, it gives them confidence. It says that, hey, the stuff that we do works, and we're on the right path, and let's just keep doing it. So I thought it was important for them. It was important for fans, and it gave me something to write about.
It seemed like almost when Charles Godfrey intercepted that pass and went in, they were already down 7-0. They tied the game. It almost felt like that sort of unlocked the box right there. And there was a sort of sigh of relief that went through the stadium, I think, because of that, because it found something good had happened.
Yeah, the world is full of talented people. The world is fairly populated with hardworking people, but it's hard to find people who are really confident, not cocky, not artificial bravado, but it's hard to find people who believe in themselves. And it's hard to find teams that believe in themselves. So much of it is how do you feel about yourself? And I think now the Panthers feel totally differently about themselves this week than they did a week ago.
So following this team as you guys do, what are the strong points to look for? What are the weak points we need to worry about this season going forward?
Well, the strong point is the guy behind center there. I mean, Cam Newton changes everything. He changes the way – he may ultimately change the way football's played a little bit at that position. I mean
– because he runs with the ball so often?
I mean, he's so big. He does everything, it seems like. And, I mean, you see Robert Griffin now sort of a similar mold there. I just think Newton gives them what they've never had before. I mean, Jake Delhomme won a lot of games and Berline had his moments. But Newton changes everything. It forces other teams to adapt to him and pay special attention. And when you have that kind of game changer, it's not everybody has that. I mean, you look at what Peyton Manning or Tom Brady, guys like that, that elevates you and puts you in a different class or at least a different potential.
How does he change the game? Seriously, for those who don't follow it as closely as you, why is he a game changer?
Well, I think he is so multi-talented. I mean, the way he can run, he has – Mick talks about confidence. I mean, Cam Newton has a ton of confidence. And you just look at him, I mean, he is – I was talking to a guy from Sports Illustrated at training camp this year who's around all the teams, but it was the first time he'd been around Cam Newton. And he just said, you see how big he is on TV, but then you stand beside him and you realize this guy's just enormous. And I think there's a physical presence, there's a confidence, and there is – and you know he's got good guys around him. That line with Jordan Gross and Ryan Khalil, smart guys who sort of know what they're doing, and I think they have, especially on offense, a lot of pieces to be really good.
There's something called the sophomore slump when it comes to quarterbacks, and this is his sophomore year. Do you think he's immune to that?
He's not immune to it, but there's no science behind the sophomore slump. That's just this alliterative pair of words that people get onto and put out there as if there's some metaphysical force in the universe that's lurking behind the nearest blocking sled, ready to jump out and put the hex on a player that had a good freshman season.
Yeah. Tom?
Yeah, I think it's a myth. In fact, Joe Person, who covers the Panthers for the Observer, did a nice piece about kind of exposing it as a myth and examined several players who had had really good rookie years. And there's nothing to it, but it sounds good. It's like the Sports Illustrated cover jinx. It's like the public radio jinx. It's like, you know, all those jinxes, none of which are based in fact.
Is a public radio jinx?
Yes.
Only
exactly.
As pertains WFA. To Tom, I believe, yes.
Whatever morning you're coming, the traffic's going to be terrible.
That's because Tom Talk never made it to public radio.
That's right.
That's what it was. It was only on commercial radio.
But, you know, Mike, don't laugh at what I'm about to say, but throughout history, there have been people who have changed the way we think about things. You know, Charles Darwin changed the way people think about how we got here, and Stephen Hawking changed the way people think about the origins of the universe, and Louis Armstrong changed the way people think about the trumpet. And this is what Cam Newton, whether he can get there or not, we do not know. But this is what he aspires to, is to change the way people think about the quarterback position in the NFL. And he's already, as Ron alluded to, he's already a long way toward doing that, even though he has authored exactly 7 wins in his young career.
So if he is the second coming, how long can we keep him?
Until I cannot imagine the laws of business physics changing in a way that you would ever think about letting him go. Mm-hmm. If he can be what the Panthers think he can be, they want him to take his first and last snaps as a Panther.
The good thing about the NFL system is it gives a lot of incentive for the player to remain with his team because there is a salary cap. It's not like a team can go out there and offer him $50 million a year. They have to get under their own salary cap. And if you're Cam Newton, the physical nature of football, you don't want to get into the last year of your contract with an eye towards free agency and risk injury in that last year. So I think, as Mick said, I think the system also helps the Panthers retain a guy like that.
That's Jim Noble, who's a pit reporter for the Performance Racing Network. Also with us, Tom Sorensen. I'll give you a chance to comment after the break, Tom. Ron Green's also with us, as is Mick Mixon, the voice of the Carolina Panthers. We're going to talk about more than just the Panthers, but we'll come back and do that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Clements Bernard, serving Charlotte and the Southeast for over 25 years, focusing on intellectual property and business litigation matters. Details at worldpatents.com. And the German Language and Culture Foundation, Jazz in the Village, celebrating German-American relations, providing funds for academic exchanges Friday, 6:30, at Johnson C. Smith University, germanfoundation.com. Fall is a time for festivals in Charlotte. This weekend, the Festival of India celebrates the culture and food of that country. Last spring, we had some guests on from India who have made Charlotte their home over the last several decades. We talked about the transition and what they've done to make Charlotte home. And so we've invited them back this time to talk about how you can enjoy their festival, their culture, and most importantly, their food. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, protests against an American-made online video mocking the Prophet Muhammad have sparked discussions about free speech, clashing cultural norms, and efforts to regulate hate speech across the globe.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning and every weekday morning from 10 until noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Talking Charlotte sports today with Mick Mixon of the Carolina Panthers, Ron Green, sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer, Tom Sorensen, also a sports writer with the Observer, and Jim Noble with the Performance Racing Network. Tom, you were trying to say something just going into the break, and I didn't give you a chance, and if you want to jump in here, now's the time.
You talked about the possibility of Cam Newton leaving, at least, you know, how long can the Panthers keep him, but in the NBA, you see superstars jump teams all the time. When that happens in the NFL, it typically is a team's idea. And Jerry Richardson, who owns the Panthers, has a really good relationship with Newton. And I just can't fathom him leaving. I think his career will be here.
How dangerous is it to his career that he carries the ball frequently and runs it?
You know, that's a great question, T. Go ahead.
I'm just saying it is dangerous. I mean, I thought he ran. The Panthers obviously saw something that they could exploit against the Saints, giving Cam Newton the ball in their victory Sunday. But I think as he gets older and wiser, and as the Panthers get older and wiser, I think he will run less and less. I mean, he's huge. He's enormous, and he's fast, and he's effective. But, you know, running the ball might be what the Panthers do better than anything else, and I think over time Cam will learn to share.
Is he doing it because he doesn't see any options downfield, or is he doing it because he's Cam Newton and he can do it? He knows he can do it, so he does it.
No, as the Dan Fogelberg song said, it's part of the plan. He's so good at it, and it puts the defense in such a bad way that a running quarterback is one of the most. It's one of the things that defenses talk about as being the most scary and the most intimidating thing. And think about it this way in terms of the injury situation too. It's much more dangerous for a QB to have his back to one side of the field and to get gored from the back by some mean, angry 300-pound rush end who's snorting and pawing the earth waiting to get at that quarterback's blind side. Cam Newton, because he faces the defense in so many of the plays from the shotgun, and because if he's a runner, he can decide when to end the play. He can slide down. He can get out of bounds. He can or he can try to fight for more yardage. So I would just put to you that a running quarterback, it's not as dangerous as people think that it is because he can put the punctuation mark on the end of the play himself.
It may be dangerous to some of those cornerbacks who see him out on the edge in the open field.
No doubt.
All right, let's move on to something else. We'll come back to the Panthers later. I want to end the show with just talking about the Panthers here. And there's a lot of stuff going on in Chapel Hill. Yesterday, Chancellor Holden Thorpe announced that he would resign at the end of the academic year, partly because of several different scandals, some of them not revolving football or sports at all. But you used to be the color guy for the Tar Heels on the broadcast on radio, Mick. Were the problems that have been uncovered recently in athletics in the football department well known and just simply not talked about, or did they surprise you when they came out?
It was a total surprise to me. I left there in 05, and at that time UNC had the reputation, I think, a national reputation of having a very clean rap sheet and trying to do things the right way. They didn't always do things in a way that created the most wins in various sports, but with the exception of a few blemishes, a little scandal here, a little greed, avarice, corruption there, for the most part, it was, you'd give them a B-plus or an A-minus, don't you guys think?
Yeah, I think so. I think everybody's surprised because there was not a false pride, but a true pride in sort of, you know, it sounds like a advertising, but the Carolina way, yep. And you had the sense they sold it, but they sold it for real, I think. And to see all this come out, as I think it's been just it's really shaken the foundation in a lot of ways. I mean, my wife is a grad, and when the whole thing started unfolding, she got so passionate that she sent an email to Holden Thorpe, and to his credit, he answered it the next morning. But she said, I used to be proud of my university, and I'm not proud anymore. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I think it's really, really bothered them.
As an outsider, not as an alum and somebody who grew up outside of Charlotte, I can tell you that growing up and when I was college age, I agree with Mick, Carolina absolutely had that reputation. It was one of the two or three public universities, big name public universities, that had not had scandal attached to its name. That's changed over the past 3 years. And I know that's a tough pill for Carolina alums to swallow, but I do think that perception has changed.
And they're not alone. Of course, the Penn State scandal, which is completely different, completely different. But that and some of the other scandals that have happened around the country, particularly with the football and sometimes with the basketball programs, is it indicative of a deeper problem that maybe athletics are too important to these universities, are too high profile, make too much money, etc.?
I think college athletics is way out of hand. I mean, it's just grown so much too big that it's just it got way away from what it was supposed to be. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy watching games on Saturday or ACC tournaments, things like that. But I think, you know, if you'd seen it 50 years ago and you came and looked at it today, you'd just go, what happened? I mean, everything's on TV.
That's what happened.
It's exactly
right
what happened.
There.
And you know, they had the long fight forever about college football playoff, and they said, well, we can't do it. It's not fair to the fans. But yet they will wait till 6 days before the game to tell the fans when it's going to be played. Mm-hmm. It's all about television. And I think, you know, money always wins out, and it's happened again.
Major universities are more complex than Fortune 500 companies. You've got so many different factions. You've got academics. You've got athletics. You've got donors, you've got sponsors and clients and people who pay enormous – you got the television component. People that pay enormous amounts of money, correct, to want to have traction, to want to have a voice. And they are – I mean, being a chancellor of a major university, being an athletic director, I mean, Ron shaking his head right now, maybe Tom is over the phone. They're just jobs that, man, you've got to be very careful you get in on. And the pyramid is set on its point. The people who are in charge and should be making the decisions don't have the power to do so, and it is scary.
Tom Sorensen, do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think if we really knew what went on behind closed doors, we would universally declare that college athletics are corrupt. You know, I think North Carolina is, you know, it's a full-blown scandal. And to the credit of a lot of the alumni, they're not mad at the media for reporting it. They're mad at their school for allowing it to happen. You know, I think Holden Thorpe, based on everything I know about him, is a brilliant guy, but he was a fan, and he just got in over his head. And while he was playing the drums at halftime and performing with the school band, you know, it was going into the tank, and it's going to take years, I think, for that school to recover. And you know, it's like scandal of the week. No, not scandal of the week. That's not fair to them. It's more like scandal of the month. But the story keeps breaking, and new components keep breaking.
So how long does this go on before major reform takes place within the NCAA or within universities themselves?
Well, I don't think it does. I think it's too lucrative a system to allow that to happen. I think it'll be, you know, individual schools getting in trouble and individual chancellors getting fired and individual coaches getting banned. But this system, per se, will endure.
Well, that's part of what makes you heartsick about it, is that the Knight Commission in the early 90s studied this. They got some of the best and brightest minds together, led by Bill Friday, longtime chancellor at UNC and system guru, and they figured out a way to fix it. But it's painful. The solutions were painful. So the colleges patted them on the head and said, good job, Knight Commission. Boy, that's a good-looking piece of work right there. Thank you all. And then they went on about their merry way. It's pitiful.
Yeah,
like it's like me. I mean, I know I shouldn't sit in front of the television and eat chips and salsa every night when I'm watching a ball game. I should go do something else, but I keep doing it. Yeah, I think the Knight Commission had the right idea, but it never had a chance.
But we've had periodic conversations on this and other programs about the NCAA and how they view college athletes and athletics, versus what the reality is. These people are making a fortune off these student athletes who can't even get a job outside of the college at McDonald's to pay the bills. Shouldn't we recognize them as being the farm teams for the pros and find a way to either pay them or do something. I know they're getting athletic scholarships, and that's a considerable amount of money in some cases, but is there another way to do this?
I've gone back and forth on that question over the years. I've flip-flopped worse than anybody else. Right now, I see in theory that being a great idea, Mike. In practice, how would you regulate? We can't regulate what we have now under a purely quote-unquote amateur system.
If you're going to be a farm team for the Panthers or in the basketball situation for the Knicks, why do they have to go to school?
You can establish minor leagues like baseball.
Why do they have to go to class? Why do we have to have these scandals where they go to these classes that no one meets at ever and they get an A at because all they have to do is sign up for the class? Just don't make them students. Just make them your team.
But still represent a university?
Yeah.
I disagree with that one. I like the idea of student athletes, but I would pay only the student athletes in revenue-producing sports. That is, I would pay football players. I would pay the men's basketball players because those are the only sports that make any money. But unless – I don't think it's a facade. There really are student athletes. You find them at Davidson. You find them at Chapel Hill. You can find them at NC State. And I think that that system is important to retain. But I also think, to be fair, you've got to pay the students, the athletes who are bringing money into the school. It's only those two sports.
There's a great piece in Atlantic Monthly. My writer colleagues could probably cite it. First and chapter, Pulitzer Prize winning author, I think who has ties to Chapel Hill, wrote it, and he basically used the word slavery, a word that we run that through a very fine filter in our society now. He used that in talking about the modern-day student-athlete, and he basically says that if we don't fix it, if it's not fixed, Mike, in the ways that you suggest, the NCAA could not defend itself against a series of class-action lawsuits from the student-athletes who want and probably deserve and have a right to their images, their deeds, the records they set, the money they help earn, and going on even after they graduate.
That's Mick Mixon, who's the radio voice of the Carolina Panthers. Also with us, Ron Green Jr. and Tom Sorensen, both of the Charlotte Observer, and Jim Noble with Performance Racing Network. It's time to talk racing here. Last time we did a show about racing, if I recall correctly, that sport was generating about $2 billion a year for this region. Is that still the case?
No. That was probably the high point, Mike, maybe 2006, 2005, maybe even before that. That was sort of the pinnacle of NASCAR's economic impact. It's certainly gone down, you know, like a lot of other things during the recession. But NASCAR has felt the brunt because obviously everybody knows NASCAR is a sponsor-driven sport. They get their money from Fortune 500 companies, you know, smaller companies with a lot of money to spend on advertising. When that dries up and when you're having trouble financially, the first thing you cut out is advertising. NASCAR sponsorship has dropped probably at one point it was about 50% what it was. I think it's bounced back a little bit now, 65, maybe 70%. It will probably never get back to the level of 7-8 years ago. But, you know, it still brings in a huge amount of money. I've often said when I moved to Charlotte, you know, ostensibly to cover the Panthers and then the Charlotte Hornets, covering NASCAR was like covering a third pro sport in right. this town with all the teams based here. So I think its effect on Charlotte can't be trivialized, but it's not like it used to be.
But is it just the decline in advertising sponsors as a result of the recession, or is it also a decline in interest around the country and even here in its homeland, fan support?
I think you could make a case in terms of fan support declining. TV ratings are about flat when they were back in the day. One of the things that I always point to is the experience of watching a game at home now. This probably translates to other sports with HD TV, with surround sound, with stats on your computer. NASCAR, you can listen to all the scanners right. on your laptop now from home. It's now harder to justify shelling out the couple $100 or whatever it takes to go sit in the stands and broil under the sun for 7 hours, you know, and parking and concessions and all that. I think that's had a bigger impact maybe than lack of interest. People are still interested.
Are they making up the revenue from television then? Nope. They can't make up the revenue.
Not like it used to be. Again, the next time the NASCAR TV contract comes around, and I think it's the year after next, but negotiations are already starting, I think the TV networks are going to get, by most estimations, 50 to 60% of what they're getting on this deal that's expiring. That's an indication that the numbers are down and that NASCAR won't get the money they thought they'd get.
I have some friends. Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say, I think that interest has fallen markedly. I think what happened is there was really a period when people who knew nothing about racing, who weren't from the Southeast, turned to the sport. You know, other sports had work stoppages because of unions. NASCAR, obviously, the drivers were not happy. And here was something fresh and new and seemingly wholesome, and people turned to it. And I just think that they found it lacking. I think that, you know, what makes a sport interesting or exciting is personal. It's subjective. But I think that collectively people just weren't engaged by NASCAR. And, you know, a lot of the promoters would tell me, well, it's the economy. But how much money does it cost to turn on your TV and watch a race? You know, the TV ratings are markedly down, too. As Jim pointed out, they've come back a little bit. But, you know, John Beeson, the linebacker for the Panthers, had said that this is a NASCAR town. And I think if you were just going to rake interest in Charlotte in the individual sports, I think NASCAR probably would come in sixth or seventh.
Bill from Matthews writes in on our email, I would like to hear your panel's thoughts. We're kind of talking about this regarding the future of NASCAR. Audiences at the tracks are declining. People complain that the season is too long. The races are too long. Are there too many tracks in locations where the support is questionable, like Fontana in California? Do we need to revisit the legacy tracks like Rockingham? Should the season begin and end in Daytona? Does the sport need to reinvent itself, or is it destined to become a dinosaur? And I have a very good friend. She is a rabid racing fan, and she likes the truck races because she says that's what racing used to be. All the fun, all the excitement, all the predictability, all the chance taking has been taken out of stock car racing.
I hear that a lot on the NASCAR show I host on the radio. The truck races are shorter. They're more intense. They run at shorter racetracks. They don't run at the super speedways. And a lot of people feel, rightfully so, that short track racing with the bumping and banging that we used to have from yesteryear, people love that sort of stuff. NASCAR has gotten away from the Southeast base and away from the smaller tracks that had more character and tried to appeal to everybody. And I think I understand the vision of that, but I don't think it's really worked out.
You know what she also says? Because I don't really follow this, but mm-hmm. I'm telling you what she says. And if a woman feels this way, you might be in big trouble. She says it's all gone to pretty boys. Pretty boy drivers who look good on television and who talk well in sound bites. And they're not the people that brought people to racing in the first place. They're not authentic.
Because sponsors now want the guy who is a good corporate spokesman, who will speak proper English when he does your commercial, and who will make your company look good. Sponsor influence is still a huge part of NASCAR, unlike any other sport. And, you know, Ron might argue with me with this analogy, but I hear it all the time that people say, my drivers, it's now like watching the PGA Tour. Of course, with a lot less more logos on the uniform.
I don't know. Some of the golfers are catching up.
But they say everybody is kind of vanilla, and we don't have the character. We don't have guys with nicknames like Fireball and Tiny and things like that like we did 30, 40 years ago.
But you can look at somebody like Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon, and if I'm trying to decide where I'm going to put my money, I want those guys. Look what Jimmy Johnson and Lowe's have done together. I mean, he's been huge for them. And Jeff Gordon, granted, DuPont, what they were doing was not necessarily to consumers so much. But, I mean, they're great corporate representatives. You know, but nothing will help NASCAR better than Dale Jr. if he could win the championship.
Yep. All right.
John Daly.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, we need to stop. We'll come back and we'll pick up on this John Daly and Dale Jr. thing because I'm not sure some people understand that, but we'll come back to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the law firm of Johnston, Alliston, and Horde. For more than a century, serving clients in a competitive landscape, believing that good counsel is more than sound legal advice. Johnston, Alliston, and Horde at jahlaw.com. And the Centralina Clean Fuels Coalition with the United Soybean Board. Soybean oil is a renewable resource from which biodiesel fuel is made. Information at unitedsoybean.com. Org. Protests against an American-made online video mocking the Prophet Muhammad have sparked discussions about free speech. Guest host Steve Roberts and his guests talk about clashing cultural norms and efforts to define and regulate hate speech across the globe. That's on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about sports, do it. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
The world moves quickly.
Information bombards you from all directions, TV, newspapers, the internet.
Which is why you need Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, to slow that news down.
To help you make sense of it.
Not by accepting the quick, easy answer.
By asking more questions, digging deep.
Helping you understand the story behind the headlines.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Your source for the latest news weekdays from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking Charlotte sports or Charlotte region sports with Mick Mixon, the voice of the Carolina Panthers, Ron Green and Tom Sorensen with the Charlotte Observer, and Jim Noble with the Performance Racing Network. We were talking about NASCAR, and one of you said, Tom, you said, you mentioned John Daly, and somebody said NASCAR needs to have Dale Jr. win the championship. Why?
I just think he's so compelling. I mean, we sort of joke about it in our office that if you want to get the most hits on the website, just put something with Dale Jr. in the headline, put it on the front, and you can see the numbers go up.
What is it about him?
It's sort of the million-dollar question. I mean, obviously the name and the legacy of his dad. And I think he reminds me in a way of the old kind of guys. His sponsors love him because of his popularity, but he doesn't seem to try to be somebody he's not. In some ways, I've often wondered it. If he wishes he had done something else because of just the burden. It's great to see him having success because I think universally throughout the sport, people like him and want him to succeed.
NASCAR doesn't have many rock stars. Mm-hmm. He's one of them. Cam Newton's a rock star. You know, that's the classification. If your rock stars aren't doing well, then – you know, that will detract from your casual fan. Your hardcore fan is always going to watch whatever sport if they're interested. But your casual fan needs that rock star quality, and he has it in NASCAR.
Where does Jeff Gordon fall in all of that?
Number two. He's probably the second most popular guy behind Dale Jr., but there was a pretty big drop-off.
Now, NASCAR instituted this playoff system a couple of years ago. I think it's called the Chase, and a lot of the usual suspects seem to be in the Chase. With last year's champ Tony Stewart, we got Jimmie Johnson plus Dale Earnhardt Jr. in the thick of it. Even Jeff Gordon is snuck in as a wild card, I'm told, this year. Any predictions on who will take the overall championship? How far away are we?
We're one race in out of 10. And Brad Keselowski won the first race, and he's leading the points. And to a casual viewer, they're like, who's Brad Keselowski? He's one of the up-and-coming stars, hasn't gotten there yet. You know, Dale Jr.'s got probably his best shot ever in terms of the Chase this year. He's sitting at about 6th or 7th in the points right now. He finished 8th in Chicago, but there's a long way to go. You know, there's a couple. Denny Hamlin is another guy who's probably a Chase favorite. He had a tough race last weekend, though.
Off the air, you said that the races, the 500-mile races, are too long for television.
I think so. I mean, you know, we have a very short attention span as the American television viewer. An NFL game fits pretty nicely into 3-hour, maybe a 3.5-hour window. College football, fairly similar. NASCAR, a 500-mile NASCAR race can go 4.5 hours easy. That's a big commitment.
So what do they do about that?
They have started to cut back a couple of the race distances. It's not just up to NASCAR, though. It's up to the track promoters working hand-in-hand with NASCAR. The short track racers are the most successful on TV, and they're the shortest races.
Does TV complain? Do they cut away for Heidi?
TV has a great deal of influence. They don't cut away for Heidi, but they make their – you know, when you are writing the millions and millions of dollar checks that you are sending out, if you're the TV network, you say, hey, we have some influence here. And the NASCAR TV networks, ESPN, Fox, and TNT aren't afraid to exert that influence.
I think it's something like our short attention span. I mean, baseball, part of what it fights now is the length of games. People say, well, it takes 3.5 hours. 4 hours if it's the Yankees and the Red Sox.
I know.
It's too long.
Yeah. If the Panthers are rebuilding somewhat this season, then one of the teams that absolutely has to be rebuilding, furiously rebuilding, the Bobcats. They must be going out and buying construction materials every day for this. What can be said about their dubious achievement last year of being the worst team in the history of the NBA, Tom?
Well, what it meant is that they got to have a really high draft pick this season. And there was one player who was almost certainly going to be a star, and the Bobcats didn't get him. But they drafted Michael Kidd-Gilchrist with the second pick, and just a great guy and really good athlete and intense. And he's the kind of guy who can help rejuvenate a franchise. They're not going to be good this season, but they're not going to be abysmal. And to their credit, they spent some money, and I think they spent it wisely. I think this team, I've been really surprised, and I'm an NBA fan, so pleasantly surprised, by the interest in this team and the interest in some of the free agent acquisitions and in the draft choices. And, you know, they open camp, I think, the first week of October up in Asheville. And, you know, I'm planning to break away from football for a while and go up there. And I think they're going to be a lot of fun to watch.
You know, it's been fun the last, I don't know, 15 or 18 years or so to really not like the owner of this team, whether it's George Shinn and the Hornets or Bob Johnson when it was the Bobcats under his ownership. It's hard to dislike Michael Jordan, arguably one of the greatest players in the history of the game, but his achievements in the front office have not been as good. Has he done anything in the off season that might reverse those fortunes?
Well, I think it's funny, as bad as they were last year, there seemed to be a little sense of enthusiasm or positive momentum with them when they went through the change, hired Mike Dunlap, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, just seem like they're trying to be proactive. I mean, after what they did last year, how could you not? I mean, they spent more time rebuilding than Home Depot, I think. But they seem to be trying. You know, you hear Michael has ceded some of the decision making to Rich Cho and some other people, and what they've done hasn't worked, and so they need to change it. And they seem to be trying to do that. I think people want to be enthused by the Bobcats. I think, especially if you were here during the Hornets years, all those years ago, you know what it can be. And they just haven't quite had the connection and the team to bring it around.
Well, was it the Hornets, even when they were losing, and they were losing almost every game in the beginning, but it was an event. It was a spectacular thing. We were in the big leagues all of a sudden, and people would flock out to the Coliseum out there on Billy Graham. It didn't matter whether they won or lost. The fact of the matter was they were on the court with their Alexander Julian uniforms, and it was an event. Can that ever be recaptured?
No. A thing can be new only once, and you get a very short window, and the Hornets use theirs up. It was magic, and, you know, for those of us who were here then, it's just something that's fun to think about. But it can't be replicated, and it won't be replicated even if the Bobcats spend a couple of $1 million and change their name to the Hornets. They're going to have to earn their support, and you know, this season will be a huge step in determining whether they do or not.
Jim,
I can't tell you how many of my neighbors, and I live in South Charlotte, and my age, you know, late 40s, say, man, I went to every Hornets game. I love the Hornets. And when they left, something was stolen from me. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, they never got into the Bobcats. I don't even know if they gave the Bobcats a chance. Bob Johnson, the way he approached things, probably didn't help.
And they were
either
tarnished by the fact that they were in this new building, and there was a lot of contention about the building, this arena
downtown.
I don't
see the building being a factor, at least not the people. I think it was more from a basketball fan standpoint. They felt like something was taken from them when the Hornets moved, and they never feel like they're giving the Bobcats a chance. The Bobcats not being good hasn't helped either.
Well, Mike Dunlap has become the team's fifth head coach. They've tried veterans like Paul Silas and Larry Brown, but now they're going to this younger coach, one who's never been a head coach at the pro level, unless you consider the Australian National Basketball League. So what was the management's thinking behind this choice?
Well, I think they wanted a guy, a tough guy. He's extremely disciplined. This is a guy who ran 100-mile races through the mountains and deserts. He's very intense, very fundamentally sound, pushes the tempo, pushes them really hard. I think Paul Silas is a great guy, knows his basketball, but it was time to sort of change the direction a little bit. I think they've got more of a, drill sergeant sort of a cliche, but I think, you know, a hard line guy who's not going to put up with anything. Here's the way we're going to do it. We're not going to vary from this. And people inside basketball, they know him. We may not know him when they hired him, but people inside basketball know him. He has a very good reputation as a great tactician, and it would be interesting to see what he can do because he's obviously not working with quite the talent, say, the Lakers have.
Well, the proposed starting lineup is pretty young, and I'm wondering if they're writing off the present in favor of the future, or do they think that they can put some games in the win column with this strategy? And how important is that to keep to not even maintain fan interest, to actually get fan interest? Because the place is pretty empty.
Well, they just have to. Anybody who follows the sport knows they're not going to win half their games this season. I mean, it's just the system works against them. What they have to do is play hard, and they have to be entertaining. They have to. When fans leave, they have to think more of those guys are fun to watch, more of those guys hustle. I'm not sold on the new coach because I don't think that rah-rah college stuff, I don't think you can make that last for 82 games. But, you know, this is important, I think. I think they were up against it from the start. Bob Johnson was the worst NBA owner the city's ever had, and that's saying something. But when the Hornets left, they left because nobody cared anymore. I mean, there wasn't this great anger. There was apathy. And there was no passion on which the Bobcats could capitalize. When people were through with the NBA, by George Shinn's last few seasons there, it was like, you know, see ya. Nobody really cared. And so they had to go from 0 to 60, and they're not there yet. But as long as they play hard, as long as fans feel like they're getting their money's worth, they'll have something to build on.
You know, you mentioned 82 games. NBA season is a long season. It goes for, three-quarters of the year almost. Baseball is pretty long. Arguably America's favorite sport is football, and of the three big sports, it has the shortest season. Should we flip the calendar around here?
It's really not that hard. I mean, what you guys are talking about is very astute. I've been listening with great interest, and, you know, sociologists have read, I'm not going to make any speeches here, but we all know that the world is different. Our attention spans are different. There are things competing for our attention spans that weren't there when George Shinn brought the Hornets and when Dale Earnhardt Sr. used to race and Cale Yarbrough. I mean, we can talk all we want to about the good old days, but they are gone.
Yeah.
So now, you can't make it too hard for people to follow the sport. If fans don't understand the FedEx Cup, if they don't understand the chase, if they don't just because trucks can race doesn't mean that they should. Just because you can build a track in Pivnik, Arizona, doesn't mean that you should.
Mick will be at the swamp buggy races that they hold next week, by the way.
Since I don't want to run out of time, but before we leave basketball, how are they doing financially? How long can they keep this up? Anybody know?
I don't know. I would think they need to win some games because they need to get more people in there. I don't know enough about that side of it, but I can't imagine it's filled with a lot of black numbers now.
If the New Orleans Hornets give up their name, would it make amount to a hill of beans if we went after it and got it back?
It would be fun, and that's about it.
That's about it.
I don't think it's suddenly going to bring 5,000 more people a night down.
Now, I know there's no golf team here, but we certainly have tournaments. We have the Wells Fargo. We're going to get the PGA tournament. What does that kind of exposure do for Charlotte? What does it do for golf? What does it do for our relationship to golf in this area?
Well, there are only four major championships a year, and you're not going to get the Masters because they're going to keep it in Augusta, from what I've learned. And the British Open didn't come in, so you really only got a chance at two. And I think it's one of the jewels. It elevates your club if you can get one there. Quail Hollow has proven beyond any question it could host one. And it's a very it's going to be a really great thing. I mean, down at Kiowa when Rory McIlroy won this year, I mean, it goes global. I think what it will do, if people have gone to the Wells Fargo and then go to the PGA Championship, they will realize what a special event they've got out there now, because it's not that far from a major championship. You hear that a lot, but it's true. Obviously, they'll get all the top players at the PGA Championship the way it is now. Guys pick and choose, but they get most of the best ones. But what they have now is, you know, it's no lie. I mean, I've listened to the best players behind closed doors talk about it. As one caddy said, it's the only tournament on the schedule where we tell the players they're going to play, because it's so good in so many ways. And it's a great thing. And
what makes it good in there? Because they're the pros. They know what
they're playing. Well, it all starts with the golf course. If they don't have a good golf course, guys aren't going to come. They're they make enough money now that they don't have to play everywhere. But they like the golf course. They like the facility. They like the way it's run. Mac Everett told me one time that their philosophy is to always say yes until you have to say no, as opposed to when somebody says, can we do this and that, people say no, and then you find a way to do it. Their answer is yes. And they have people there, and Mac and Johnny Harris, Kim Huffman, who know how to do it right. They study the best events. They've had the benefit of, you know, they've got a nice budget, I would assume. They can probably spend more money than some other places, and they make it all work.
We've talked a lot here this morning about how we have so much competing for our attention, and we have limited time and limited time spans of interest. But we also have, in addition to these big sports, we have minor league teams. I didn't know until yesterday, for instance, that we have not one but two professional lacrosse teams, an indoor and an outdoor team, the Hounds and the Copperheads. And at least I think at the Hounds game, I'm told, at least one of them, they play at CPCC's Memorial Stadium, mm-hmm. and they have tailgate parties that rival what's going on at the Panthers. What's up with that?
I played lacrosse in college, so A, be careful. But two, I've always said it's hard to be a minor league sport in a major league town. I think this translates back to the Charlotte Knights. I think it's great when it's 1982 right. and the minor league baseball team is a big deal. People will go out to see it. Maybe not a big deal, but you know, bigger than it is. It's hard now.
I didn't even put that on my list to talk about, and I should have, because they're building a stadium downtown. What about the Knights moving uptown? Will that have an impact? Will people come out to the games, et cetera?
I think they're going to – go ahead, Tom.
If it happens, and I don't – Jerry Reese, the real estate attorney whose hobby is filing frivolous lawsuits, probably isn't finished. And he may try to impede this one from getting built. But I think it's just a boon for downtown. I think minor league sports are important as long as they charge minor league prices. I've never seen a lacrosse match, amateur or pro, but I'm glad they're here. Mm. And when my kids were young, I loved taking them to minor league baseball because it was cheap and because they could run around a little bit. It was just a lot of fun. And it was almost, you felt as if you were part of something. You didn't know who the players were. You went because you liked the game. And they still do. And I think baseball downtown, I mean, the idea of just walking over there after a long 4 or 5 hour day, or 8 or 9 or 10 hour day.
Let me stop you there. Tom Sorensen and Ron Green with The Observer, Jim Noble with Performance Racing Network, and Mick Mixon, Thursday night, Carolina Panthers Radio Network. Thanks for coming.